the research project I had initiated. Bundy said that he wanted to assist us by becoming a consultant to the BSU. This prompted my second visit to his Florida prison. Bundy stuck out his hand even before I'd put mine forward. I started to introduce myself, and he said, "Oh, Mr. Ressler, I know who you are. I've been reading your stuff for years." He had many of the BSU's published reports in his cell, and he wondered why I hadn't come to see him earlier. I reminded him that I had done so, but had been unable to wait out the appeal. Bundy regretted his earlier unavailability and said he was eager to talk because, "I like to talk to somebody I can relate to, who understands what I am saying." It was a clear attempt on his part to control me, and I was glad to understand that as we sat down to chat. Bundy continued to try to flatter me by saying that the various college professors, newsmen, and local police officers who had interviewed him had all been amateurs, but now he was talking with a professional. He had written his letter in an attempt to obtain our research and use it for his appeals to stave off his death sentence. Believe it or not, one of my superiors in the FBI wanted to give that research to this convicted killer. I refused to do so. I told Bundy that the only crimes we were interested in talking about were his own. Bundy wouldn't look me in the eye. He said he'd win on appeal anyway and would never be executed. After further fencing, he agreed to discuss some of the murders on a hypothetical basis. One of the cases, the one that had gotten him charged in Colorado, involved the abduction of a woman from a hotel bar when she was with her boyfriend. I asked him how this could have been accomplished. Using the third person, Bundy told me that it could have happened this way. The killer might have had the woman under surveillance and perhaps approached her in the hall, posing as a security guard or an official in the hotel, someone with a bit of authority in this place, and, by a ruse or a trick, lured her to a specific room where he could disable her quickly. It was most likely that Bundy was telling me precisely how he had committed this particular crime, but he wouldn't say so directly. After 3 or 4 hours of this sort of dancing around the issues, I realized that Bundy would never talk, that he would attempt to con people, as he had done so successfully, until executed, and I went home. Just 3 or 4 days prior to his execution, some months later, Bundy said that he would tell all, and a dozen officers from around the country came to interview him, each one allotted a few hours. The first to speak with him was Robert Keppel from Seattle, who had meticulously tracked Bundy's first 11 murders. Bundy spent the hours allotted to Keppel verbally sparring around the first murder and never got to the other murders. He informed the officer that this task was going to take longer than he had thought it would, and that if the policemen got together and petitioned so that Bundy would be allowed another 6 to 8 months of life, they'd be able to get to the bottom of many things. This didn't wash. He'd had 10 years in jail in which to reveal the details, and it was clear that he would never do so. Bundy was executed several days later. When all of those police officers came from Florida to Quantico for our seminar, I learned a disturbing fact. Bundy had managed one last con job. He had previously convinced someone else in the Bureau to obtain from me an autographed copy of my textbook on serial murder, and had it in his cell at the time he went to the electric chair. He even quoted from it in his last videotaped interview with Dr. James Dobson. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Keller, sat with me and my associates 3 times in mid-1979. In the space of a single year in New York, Berkowitz had killed a half dozen people, mostly in cars parked in lovers' lanes, and seriously injured a half dozen more. He had left notes for the police at the scenes of his crimes and communicated with newspaper columnists during a reign of terror that had many New Yorkers staying home at nights. At the time of our interviews, Berkowitz was in Attica Prison, isolated from the rest of the population. Berkowitz was, as he had appeared in court at the time of his trial, pudgy, pasty, extremely shy, reserved, polite, low-key. He accepted my handshake readily, always a good predictor of how well the interview will go, I had discovered. Then he sat down and spoke only when spoken to. I took handwritten notes, as he indicated he did not want a tape recorder running. Since Berkowitz's crimes were committed in New York City, there had been even more than the usual media interest in the crimes and in him. That had provided a lot of material to read through as I prepared to meet Berkowitz. As I soon noted, it was also the basis for a complex interaction between Berkowitz and the New York newspapers. Among other matters, I learned that Berkowitz had a scrapbook in which he had pasted the newspaper stories about his crimes. Many criminals compile these memento books prior to their arrest, but Berkowitz had been allowed to keep his scrapbook in his cell, and, he told me, he used it to keep his fantasies alive. What I really wanted to talk to Berkowitz about was the sexual content of his crimes. At first he didn't want to discuss it, saying that he had a normal sex life with girlfriends and that the murders were just shootings. So I asked him about his early life. He had been adopted when very young and had had problems with the adopted family. He had always wanted to locate his birth mother, especially after his adoptive mother died when he was 14. On graduating from high school, he wanted to go into the Army and to Vietnam. He envisioned himself becoming a hero, receiving medals, being recognized as an important individual, and thereby fashioning an identity for himself. Instead, the Army sent him to Korea, where he had an undistinguished year of service. He went to a prostitute to gain sexual experience and was deeply disappointed when he contracted a case of venereal disease. Later, he would tell interviewers that this was his sole consummated sexual experience with a woman. Returning home, Berkowitz managed to locate his birth mother. He met with her and with his half-sister, who was living with the birth mother, but this, too, was a disappointing experience. He wanted the birth mother to take him in and make him part of the family, and things didn't work out that way. Before committing his murders, Berkowitz had set at least 1,488 fires in New York. That's an amazing number, and we know it only because he kept a diary of them. He had also pulled several hundred false alarms. He had a desire to be a fireman, but never took the qualifying test. He did participate in some fireman-type rescues in the course of his duties as a security guard for a private trucking firm in Queens. At the point in our interview where he came to describe the murders, Berkowitz started to say, as he had to psychiatrists who had examined him for the court, that his neighbor Sam Carr's dog, possessed by a 3,000-year-old demon, had barked orders at him, instructing him to kill. I told Berkowitz that I thought this explanation was nonsense and that I didn't accept it. Stunned, Berkowitz continued to advance the demon dog story. I reiterated that if this was the extent of his being honest with us, to attribute the motive of his crimes to a talking dog, the interview was over. I shut my notebook and started to leave the room. Berkowitz stopped me, protesting that the psychiatrists had accepted his story as the reason for his crimes, and if it was good enough for them, it should be good enough for the FBI. "That's not the story we're looking for, David," I said. "We want the factual basis for these crimes, and if we're not going to talk about that, then we'll leave." Berkowitz sighed, settled down, and began to talk about the real stuff. The Son of Sam business, and the assertion about the talking dog, he indicated, had been his way of signaling the authorities that he was insane. In other words, it was a construct made for the purpose of attempting to avoid proper prosecution for his crimes. He had been sane enough to know what he was doing. By the time I interviewed him, Berkowitz also had done enough talking with psychiatrists and other counselors in prison to be somewhat comfortable conversing about the true basis for his crimes. He admitted that his real reason for shooting women was out of resentment toward his own mother, and because of his inability to establish good relationships with women. His first attempt at murder had been a stabbing. He had sliced a knife through a woman on the street, then had run away. He'd looked through the newspapers after the crime, but saw no notice of it, and so he concluded that she had lived. He then decided to improve his M.O. The knife, he reasoned, had been a mistake. It had resulted in too much blood on him and on his clothes, and he didn't like that. So, with the precise intention of finding a weapon with which to kill, he had traveled to Texas and bought a Charter Arms 44 pistol and some bullets. He was afraid to buy the bullets in New York, thinking that somehow if he did so, and the bullet shells were found, the authorities would be able to trace them to his New York residence. After committing several of the murders, Berkowitz even went back to Texas in order to purchase additional bullets. His M.O. was to look for women alone in cars or necking with men in parked cars. Then he'd walk up and shoot the women, and sometimes the men with them. He told me that in the process of stalking and shooting women, he would become sexually excited, and that after the shootings he would masturbate. Now we were getting toward the heart of the matter. Under my gentle probing, Berkowitz said something that hadn't been widely known, that stalking for victims was a nightly occupation. It didn't depend on phases of the moon, particular days of the week, or any other matter that had been advanced as a theory by those who tried to solve the case. He was out looking every night, but would strike only when he felt the circumstances were ideal. This amount of premeditation alone cuts the ground from under any instant analysis of Berkowitz as an insane killer. Berkowitz told me that on the nights when he couldn't find a proper victim or proper circumstances, he would drive back to the scenes of earlier murders he had committed and revel in the experience of being where he had formerly accomplished a shooting. It was an erotic experience for him to see the remains of bloodstains on the ground, a police chalk mark or two. Seated in his car, he would often contemplate these grisly mementos and masturbate. No wonder that he kept his scrapbook in his cell. In this single moment of revelation, almost casually given, Berkowitz told us something extremely important for law enforcement and, at the same time, provided new understanding to a staple of detective stories. Yes, murderers did indeed return to the scene of their crimes, and we could try to catch future murderers on that basis. Equally as important, the world could now understand that this return to the scene of the crime arose not out of guilt, which had been the usual explanation accepted by psychiatrists and mental health professionals, but because of the sexual nature of the murder. Returning to the murder site took on a connotation that Sherlock Holmes, Hercule Poirot, or even Sam Spade had never dared to suggest. For me, the revelation also had another reverberation. I had long argued that the aberrant behavior of killers is, in some ways, only an extension of normal behavior. Every parent of an adolescent girl has observed that teenage boys will repeatedly walk or ride their bikes or drive their cars by a girl's house, or hang around as close to her as they are allowed, and engage in impetuous, spontaneous behavior. Hanging around the scene of the crime, then, is an instance of arrested, inadequate personality development, an extension of something normal into abnormal behavior. Berkowitz had felt a great urge to go to the funerals of his victims. Many killers do so. He didn't, fearful that police would be watching the ceremonies, as indeed they were. Berkowitz had learned from television shows and detective magazines that such events were watched by police. He did take off from work on the days of funerals and often hung around diners near police stations to try and overhear cops talking about his crimes. He heard nothing. Although he didn't go to the funerals, he would go so far as to try and locate the graves of his victims, which he was also unable to do. Berkowitz was incredibly ineffectual at anything other than setting fires and murdering people. He liked the idea of becoming notorious, and that was why he communicated with the police and, later, directly with the newspapers. The power that he held over the city and over the sale of newspapers was stupendous and very exciting for him. Having read about the idea of communicating with the police from a book on Jack the Ripper, He slipped a note into the seat of the car in which his first victim lay dying, a note in crude letters that read, "Bang, bang, I'll be back," and was signed with the appellation Mr. Monster. At that point, Berkowitz was not the son of Sam. That phrase was a minor part of a letter that he sent to the newspapers. Only after the press started calling him Son of Sam did he adopt the moniker as his own and even fashioned a logo for it. Publicity spurred his creativity. In my view, such people as newspaper columnist Jimmy Breslin baited Berkowitz and irresponsibly contributed to the continuation of his murders. Breslin wrote columns about the Son of Sam, and the killer sent him letters directly. After the initial murders, when the city was gripped by fear, Berkowitz came to be directed by the media. For instance, the papers would draw maps to indicate that the killer had struck in several of the boroughs of the city, and would wonder in print whether he was going to hit them all in turn. Berkowitz hadn't really considered doing so, but after the map and articles appeared, he decided he'd try. The story was kept alive even when there was nothing new to report because it sold newspapers. It was clear to everyone, even the most doltish of newspapermen, that Berkowitz wished to be famous, or infamous, and was murdering in order to impress and shock society and thereby gain attention and identity. Feeding that ego by consistently printing and televising stories about the murders was assuring that there would be more murders. Perhaps, since this was New York, there was no hope of controlling media attention to the case or keeping it at a low enough level not to hamper police or incite the killer. But it has always been clear to me that David Berkowitz kept on killing so he would continue to be the focus of columnists such as Jimmy Breslin. In his adolescent years, Berkowitz admitted to me, he had started developing these fantasies that involved sex, but also violent acts, disruptive and homicidal themes mingling with normal erotic ones. Even earlier in his life, at 6 or 7, he remembered pouring ammonia into his adoptive mother's fish tank to kill her fish, and spearing them with a pin. He also killed her pet bird with rat poison. He got a thrill out of watching the bird die slowly, and from his mother's anguish at being unable to reverse the illness. He tortured small animals, such as mice and moths. All of these were control fantasies involving power over living things. Berkowitz also confided to me his fantasies about wishing to cause fiery air crashes. He had actually never interfered with an airplane, but arson was a logical extension of this fantasy. Most arsonists like the feeling that they are responsible for the excitement and violence of a fire. With the simple act of lighting matches, they control events in society that are not normally controlled. They orchestrate the fire, the screaming arrival and deployment of the fire trucks and firefighters, the gathering crowds, the destruction of property and sometimes of people. Berkowitz loved to watch bodies being carried out of burning buildings. These fires were all a prelude to his moving into the arena in which he could exercise the ultimate in control. Homicide. Here was a man who obtained his biggest thrills in life from sitting at home and watching the news on television as it reported his latest killing and the fear that he caused to grip the city. What about his courtroom antics? The suggestion that he had been demonically possessed. All nonsense, he told me, brought to the fore in hopes of mounting an insanity defense. He believed he had been caught just in time, he said, because his fantasy had been growing to the point where he envisioned going out in a blaze of glory. He imagined going to a disco where lots of couples were dancing and just shooting up the place until the police came and there was a Hollywood-style gun battle in which he and many others would be killed. Berkowitz's final fantasy was a remarkably vivid display of his envy of normal people involved in normal heterosexual relationships. He recognized that envy and told me earnestly that if, before he got into the bizarre murders, he had been able to have a relationship with a good woman who would accept him, fulfill his fantasies, and marry him, he would not have begun the killings. It was a nice note on which to end the interview. But I didn't believe Berkowitz then, and don't now. a good woman would not have solved his problems or prevented murders. The reality is that he had tremendous inadequacies, that his problems went far deeper than rejection by women, and stemmed from fantasies that began to surface at the age when most males are entering into their first important personal relationships with members of the opposite sex. It was these fantasies, and the behaviors that embodied them, that prevented his having a mature relationship with a woman. As with so many of the criminals that I interviewed, he had grown up to murder. 4. Childhoods of violence. Where do we come from? Who are we? Where are we going? These three great questions from Gauguin's triptych were the real subject of the prison interviews of murderers I had started on my own in the late 1970s. I wanted to know what made these people tick, to understand better the mind of the murderer. Shortly, my curiosity became systematized, and the interviews brought under the umbrella of the Bureau. They became the core of the Criminal Personality Research Project, partially funded by the Justice Department and involving Dr. Anne Burgess of Boston University and other academics, with myself as principal investigator. Using a research protocol of some 57 pages, we interviewed 36 individual incarcerated murderers, concentrating on their histories, their motives and fantasies, their specific actions. Eventually, we were able to discern important patterns in their lives and learn something about their developing motivation to murder. In the opinion of a number of experts, our study was the largest, most rigorous, and most complete investigation of multiple murderers ever undertaken, one that included the greatest percentage of the living incarcerated multiple murderers. In a 1986 article, forensic psychiatrists Drs. Katie Bush and James L. Cavanaugh, Jr. of Chicago's Isaac Ray Center called the research exemplary because of its breadth and said that its conclusions warrant evaluation in great detail. Before going into the details of who these murderers are and how they became murderers, let me state unequivocally that there is no such thing as the person who at age 35 suddenly changes from being perfectly normal and erupts into totally evil, disruptive, murderous behavior. The behaviors that are precursors to murder have been present and developing in that person's life for a long, long time, since childhood. A common myth is that murderers come from broken, impoverished homes. Our sample showed that this wasn't really true. Many of the murderers started life in a family that was not desperately poor, where family income was stable. More than half lived initially in a family that appeared to be intact, where the mother and father lived together with their son. These were, on the whole, intelligent children. Though 7 of the 36 had IQ scores below 90, most were in the normal range, and 11 had scores in the superior range above 120. Nonetheless, though the homes seemed to outward appearances to be normal, they were in fact dysfunctional. Half of our subjects had mental illness in their immediate family. Half had parents who had been involved in criminal activities. Nearly 70% had a familial history of alcohol or drug abuse. All the murderers, every single one, were subjected to serious emotional abuse during their childhoods, and all of them developed into what psychiatrists label as sexually dysfunctional adults, unable to sustain a mature consensual relationship with another adult. From birth to age 6 or 7, studies have shown the most important adult figure in a child's life is the mother, and it is in this time period that the child learns what love is. Relationships between our subjects and their mothers were uniformly cool, distant, unloving, neglectful. There was very little touching, emotional warmth, or training in the ways in which normal human beings cherish one another and demonstrate their affection and interdependence. These children were deprived of something more important than money, love. They ended up paying for that deprivation during the remainder of their lives. And society suffered, too, because their crimes removed many people from the world, and their assault of behavior left alive equally as many victims who remained permanently scarred. The abuse that the children endured was both physical and mental. Society has understood somewhat that physical abuse is a precursor to violence, but the emotional component may be as important. One woman propped her infant son in a cardboard box in front of the television set and left for work. Later, she'd put him in a playpen, toss in some food, and let the TV set be the babysitter until she came home again. A second man reported to us that he had been confined to his room during his childhood evenings. When he wandered into the living room at such times, he was shooed away and told that evening was the time when his mother and father wanted to be alone together. He grew up believing he was an unwanted boarder in his own home. These children grew up in an environment in which their own actions were ignored, and in which there were no limits set on their behavior. It is part of the task of parenting to teach children what is right and wrong. These were the children who managed to grow up without being taught that poking something into a puppy's eye is harmful and should not be done, or that destroying property is against the rules. The task of the first half dozen years of life is socialization, of teaching children to understand that they live in a world that encompasses other people as well as themselves, and that proper interaction with other people is essential. The children who grow up to murder never truly comprehend the world in other than egocentric terms, because their teachers, principally their mothers, do not train them properly in this important matter. Richard Chase, the vampire killer discussed in the first chapter of this book, killed a half dozen people before he was apprehended. According to psychiatric interviews conducted in conjunction with Chase's sentencing, Chase's mother was a schizophrenic, emotionally unable to concentrate on the task of socializing her son or to care for him in a loving way. The mothers of 9 more subjects of the study also had major psychiatric problems. Even those mothers whose problems did not reach the level where they came to the attention of a mental health professional could be considered dysfunctional in other ways. For instance, many were alcoholic. Neglect has many faces. Ted Bundy summed it up when he reminded an interviewer that he had not come from a leave-it-to-beaver home. He had been brought up by a woman who he thought was his sister but was actually his mother. And although there was no neglect or abuse pinpointed in that relationship, there were strong indications that Bundy was physically and sexually abused by other members of his family. Sometimes the mother, even when nurturing, cannot balance out or offset the destructive behavior of the father. One murderer came from a family in which the father was in the Navy, was often away on assignments, and was present only occasionally. The children went into a panic when he did come home, because he would then beat up his wife and the children and sexually abuse the son, who later became a murderer. Over 40% of the murderers reported being physically beaten and abused in their childhoods. More than 70% said they'd witnessed or been part of sexually stressful events when young, a percentage many times greater than that usually found in the general population. "I slept with my mother as a young child," said one. "I was abused by my father from age 14," said another. "My stepmother tried to rape me," reported a third. "I got picked up downtown one night by some guy when I was around 7 or 8, said a fourth man. The quality of a child's attachments to others in the family is considered the most important factor in how he or she eventually relates to and values non-family members of society. Relationships with siblings and other family members, which might make up for a parent's coolness in these situations, were similarly deficient in the murderers' families. These children, nurtured on inadequate relationships in their earliest years, had no one to whom they could easily turn, were unable to form attachments to those closest to them, and grew up increasingly lonely and isolated. It is true that most children who come from dysfunctional early childhoods don't go on to murder or to commit other violent antisocial acts. As far as we could see, the reason for this is that the majority are rescued by strong hands in the next phase of childhood, that of pre-adolescence. But our subjects were definitely not saved from drowning. they were pushed further under in this phase of their lives. From the ages of 8 to 12, all the negative tendencies present in their early childhoods were exacerbated and reinforced. In this period, a male child really needs a father, and it was in just this time period that the fathers of half the subjects disappeared in one way or another. Some fathers died, some were incarcerated, most just left through divorce or abandonment. Other fathers, while physically present, drifted away emotionally. John Gacy killed 33 young men and buried them beneath his home before he was caught. In Gacy's youth, his father used to come home, go down into the basement, sit in a stuffed chair, and drink. When anyone approached, the father would chase them away. Later, drunk, he'd come up for dinner and pick fights and beat his wife and children. John Jubert killed 3 boys before he was caught. John's mother and father divorced when he was a pre-adolescent, and when John wanted to see his father, his natural mother refused to take him to the father's residence or provide money for his trip. That's abuse, too, in a manner psychologists call passive-aggressive. Now, divorce in the United States is a very common occurrence, and hundreds of thousands of children grow up in single-parent homes. Only a handful of them go on to commit murder. I'm not impugning single-parent homes. Rather, I am recognizing the fact that the preponderance of murderers in our study came from dysfunctional settings, many of which were rendered dysfunctional by divorce. Monty Ralph Rissell raped a dozen women and killed 5 of them before he was 19. His parents had divorced when he was 7, after which his mother moved with her 3 children from Virginia to California. Monty was the youngest, and he cried all the way across the country in the car. When I interviewed him in prison years later, Monty told me that if he had been allowed to go with his father instead of his mother at the time of the divorce, he would have been in law school now, not in a penitentiary for life. His conclusion is debatable, though the sentiment is real. In any event, he'd had quite a childhood. Monty began life as an RH baby who required a complete blood transfusion, but was afterward healthy, though always small for his age. His parents fought for several years before they divorced. He claims he was exposed to marijuana and alcohol by his older siblings before he was 7. His first recorded antisocial behavior came at age 9, when he and several other boys were caught by the school principal while writing obscene words on the sidewalk. There were problems in the home as well. His mother and new stepfather were spending a lot of time by themselves, leaving the children to supervise one another, and then arbitrarily punishing them if something went wrong. In our interview, Monty repeatedly claimed that his stepfather didn't know how to raise children, having been away in the military for much of his adult life. He would buy things for his new stepchildren, attempting to purchase their love, but did not know how to relate to them in other ways. Monty was still just 9 years old when he took out his early anger on a cousin, shooting at him with a BB gun that his stepfather had bought for him. After the incident, his stepfather smashed the gun and then beat Monty with the barrel. Monty felt he and his sister were responsible for the breakup of his mother's second marriage, which came when he was 12. That year, back in Virginia, he broke into an apartment and stole some property. At age 13, he was charged by the police with driving without a license, and at 14 with burglary, larceny, car theft, and 2 rapes. Monty Rissell was quite advanced in his deviant behavior by his early teens, but the escalation of this behavior replicates the development of many murderers. Another murderer of women had antisocial tendencies that surfaced early. Premature at birth, the man was the last of 4 children of a Mobile, Alabama family that was both poor and abusive. The story of his having been in an incubator for 9 days became a family legend, as did the tale of an apparent seizure a few months later, during which the man believed he died and was revived. During his first 6 years, he slept in the same bed with his mother, and for 12 years after that, he slept in the same room with his mother in a separate bed. This was done, the mother later claimed, to protect her from the advances of the alcoholic father. She treated her son as if he was quite special, but also abused him. She was strict with her four children, at times hitting them with an electrical cord. Additionally, she left them daily in the care of her mother, who beat the children if they disobeyed. The man's two older brothers quickly left the family when they graduated from high school, and after they were gone, the mother, the grandmother, and the sister used the man to ward off the drunken father, encouraging the boy to hit the father to keep him away from the mother. In school, the boy's performance was spotty, and a principal wrote in a report that he was often lost in fantasy, a description seconded by his sister. At puberty, he gained and then lost 30 pounds and was openly vitriolic toward his mother. She reports that he would become violent because he wanted two hot dogs instead of one, or because he was unable to have chocolate syrup on his ice cream. He stole female underwear and spied on his sister in the bathroom. In a later autobiographical statement, the murderer wrote, "I was a freak in others' eyes. I chose to swallow the insults. I was a dog who got petted when I used the paper." At age 13, he started to snatch purses and became involved in gang fights. His family continued to protect him, however. At age 16, he was charged with snatching the purse of an elderly blind woman and attempting to assault and rape her 14-year-old niece. During the time that these charges were being investigated, another elderly woman in the community who talked to the boy about his wrongdoing was shot in the head and killed. The physical evidence pointed to this boy, but the father lied about his whereabouts at the time of the murder, and the mother hired a lawyer and he got all the charges dismissed. Many years later, after conviction on other murder charges, the killer admitted that he had shot the woman. 2 years after these incidents, the killer completed high school and enlisted in the military, in effect leaving parental supervision and intervention behind him. Within a month of his induction, he was charged with the attempted murder of a young woman, convicted, and sentenced to 20 years in military prison. While in that system, he again received support from his mother, who instigated appeals to congressmen and attempts to reverse the conviction on technical grounds. After serving 7 years, and over the objection of some mental health professionals who had tried to treat him and were rebuffed, he was paroled in the care of his mother. He soon married a divorced woman with several children, who reported that relations between them were somewhat normal at first, though marred by strange incidents. When she said she was depressed over the actions of her ex-husband and wanted to commit suicide, the new husband said he would kill her and started to suffocate her with a pillow. At other times, especially when he had been drinking, he would threaten to crush her skull if she did not leave him alone. She also noted with horror that he had killed a pet rabbit by bashing it against a post, covering himself with blood. The turning point in their relationship was the birth of a daughter, after which his behavior became erratic, and he isolated himself from his wife and their child. Shortly thereafter, and within 2 years of having been paroled, he began a series of rapes, murders, and mutilations of several women, choosing those who were clerks in convenience stores. Caught in connection with the third one, he confessed to the others. Potential murderers became solidified in their loneliness, first during the age period of 8 to 12. Such isolation is considered the single most important aspect of their psychological makeup. Many factors go into fashioning this isolation. Among the most important is the absence of a father. When there's no father or father figure present for an 8 or 10 or 12-year-old boy, this is embarrassing for the child in front of his peers. He begins to avoid friends, to avoid situations in which father and son teams are usually present, such as Little League or the Boy Scouts. His pre-adolescent sexual activity, rather than being connected to other human beings, starts as autoerotic. More than three-quarters of the murderers we investigated began autoerotic sexual practices as pre-adolescents. Half reported rape fantasies occurring between the ages of 12 and 14. More than 80% admitted to using pornography, and to tendencies toward fetishism and voyeurism. Again, we must realize that many boys grow up in homes without a father and do not turn into sociopaths, but for the ones who do become sociopaths, the 8 to 12 period is critical. Investigation often leads back to just this time and the set of circumstances in which the father figure is absent as the period when bizarre behavior began. When Ed Kemper was 10, after his parents' divorce, he returned home one day to find that his mother and older sisters had taken his belongings from his second-floor room and moved them into the basement. His mother, Clarnell Strandberg, was greatly respected at the university, where she worked as an administrator, for her concern for the students. At home, she was a terror, continually belittling Kemper, telling him he was responsible for all the shortcomings in her life. She told him that she had banished him to the basement because he was so large that he was making his adolescent sisters uncomfortable. Shortly afterward, Kemper, a big hulk brooding alone in a windowless room, began to have murderous fantasies. As the psychologically damaged boys get closer to adolescence, they find that they are unable to develop the social skills that are precursors to sexual skills and that are the coin of positive emotional relationships. Loneliness and isolation do not always mean that the potential killers are introverted and shy. Some are, but others are gregarious with other men and good talkers. The outward orientation of the latter masks their inner isolation. By the time a normal youngster is dancing, going to parties, participating in kissing games, the loner is turning in on himself and developing fantasies that are deviant. The fantasies are substitutes for more positive human encounters, and as the adolescent becomes more dependent on them, he loses touch with acceptable social values. Jerome Brudos, at 12 and 13, began to abduct girls his own age or younger at knife point and take them into the barn on the family farm. There he would tell them to disrobe, and then he would photograph them, but do nothing else, since he was not sexually aware enough to go further. Then he'd lock them in a corn crib and go away. Minutes later, he would reappear in the barn with his clothes changed and his hair combed differently, unlock the corn crib, and announce to the girl that he was Ed, Jerry's twin brother. He would profess horror that Jerry had locked her in there and say, "He didn't hurt you, did he?" The girl would explain that Jerry had taken pictures, and Ed would locate the camera and destroy the film in it, then say, "Jerry's been in therapy. We have him in psychological counseling. This is going to set him back a lot. Please don't tell my parents or anyone about this." The girl would acquiesce. Later in life, Brudos put advertisements in campus newspapers asking for women to come and model shoes and hose for him. When they arrived for appointments in his motel room, he would abduct and murder some of them, then hang them in his garage and photograph them, either nude or in various outfits, and especially shoes, that he had put on the dead bodies. The key to these murderers, if there is one, lies in the unremittingly sexual nature of their deeds. To a man, they were dysfunctional sexually. That is, they were unable to have and maintain mature, consensual sexual experiences with other adults, and they translated that inability into sexual murders. Not everyone who is unable to participate in kissing games becomes a sexually dysfunctional adult. It's also important to recognize that having a good adult sexual relationship does not imply only heterosexual activity. There is such a thing as a successful homosexual relationship that is normal when looked at from the standpoint of encompassing two people who care for each other. Those killers in our sample who were homosexual were also dysfunctional in this regard, unable to maintain long-term relationships, showing a decided preference for bondage, torture, and sadomasochism in their short-term partnerships. Nearly half the murderers reported to us that they had never had a consenting sexual experience with another adult. As important, all the murderers knew they had not had normal relationships, and they resented not having them. It was this resentment that fueled their aggressive, murderous behavior. Richard Lawrence Marquette picked up a woman in a bar. They had known one another slightly during their childhoods. At his residence, according to his later confession, he was unable to perform sexually. The woman ridiculed this inability, so he killed her and chopped her up in small pieces. Incarcerated for 13 years for this murder and then released, Marquette picked up 2 more women in similar circumstances, tried and failed to have sex with them, and killed them too, before being apprehended and returned to prison. Adolescence in these troubled youngsters was dominated by increasing isolation and acting out behavior, with lots of daydreaming, compulsive masturbation, lying, bedwetting, and nightmares as concomitants of the isolation. There was more opportunity at this stage for antisocial behavior. Instead of being in the house or yard all the time, the youngster was now in school, on the streets, away from the home. Cruelty to animals and to other children, running away, truancy, assaults on teachers, setting fires, destroying the property of others and their own property, these overt acts began in adolescence, though the mindset that generated them was present earlier, but had been below the surface because the child had been controlled in his home environment. Many of the murderers were intelligent, but they did not do well in school. "I failed the second grade because I was uneducable," one murderer told us. His parents wanted to take him out of school to work on their farm. "But then I skipped the third grade because I passed the second grade and went on and excelled in many areas and dropped out in others. I excelled in math but couldn't spell." Their spotty record in school was a pattern that carried over later in life. Most were incapable of holding jobs or living up to their intellectual potential. They were not successful employees and were fired often, involved in disputes at the workplace, and had continual problems with authority. They had the intellect necessary for skilled jobs, but most of them were employed in menial capacities. When they went into the military, as about 40% did, most of them received less than honorable discharges. Just as there had been very little love in the family environment, there was also a lack of stimulation or encouragement to achieve within the family and the school. Their energy became directed to negative outlets. In school, they were either chronically disruptive or subdued and withdrawn to the extent that no one paid them any attention. "I felt guilty of having those thoughts toward family," Rissell told me, after years of listening to psychologists and picking up their jargon, "and submerged them and built up lots of hostility, and then it gets off into fantasy. They should have noticed it at school. So excessive was my daydreaming that it was always in my report cards. I was dreaming about wiping out the whole school." School systems, as well as families, fail these children. Too often, confronted with a problem child, a school system does not get him to counseling. Or, if counseling is done, it does not address the significant issues in his life, especially including those pertaining to the dysfunctional home. If a teacher says, "You ought to look at Joe, he has problems," the school system is unable to properly examine Joe's life, unable to get at the root of those problems in the home, unable to move other bureaucracies, such as the social services system, to the point where these could interrupt the downward spiral to salvage the child. Moreover, since the damage to the child is emotional, it is not easy to reach. These above-average intelligence children find ways to disguise and conceal their mental wounds until they are covered over with thick scar tissue. Many people survive enormous difficulties in childhood and don't grow up to murder. However, when the problems of childhood are reinforced by added neglect in the school, the social services system, and the neighborhood, they steadily worsen. In a situation where you find a distant mother, an absent or abusive father and siblings, a non-intervening school system, an ineffective social services system, and an inability of the person to relate sexually in a normal way to others, you have almost a formula for producing a deviant personality. I am often asked why I don't discuss female serial killers. Only one female has been arrested and accused as a serial killer, Eileen Warnos in Florida. Although there may be others, my extensive research has not come across them. Women do commit multiple murders, of course, but they tend to do so in a spree and not sequentially, as is the pattern with the men I am discussing. Do the psychological impairments that characterize the men also describe the personalities of violent women? Frankly, I don't know. Such research remains to be conducted. Serial killers are mostly male, white, and in their 20s or 30s at the time of their murders. The ability to initiate, maintain, and develop good interpersonal relationships begins in childhood and is reinforced in the preteen years. But if it isn't there at the beginning and is not positively reinforced in those preteen years, by the time a boy reaches adolescence, it's almost too late. Although the acting out behavior may not be murder or rape, it will be some other sort of demonstration of dysfunction. People whose childhoods have been deeply impaired do not go on to wholly normal lives. They become the alcoholic mothers or the abusive fathers who create home environments that perpetuate the cycle of abuse and make it highly likely that their children will become offenders. Dysfunctional adults produce a hothouse environment in which criminal fantasies and behavior are nurtured to the detriment of their children and of society. There are always points of intervention, ways to retard the offending behavior of the potentially dangerous child who has had a bad life up to, say, 12 years of age. A new and loving stepfather or a teacher or a big brother might enter the picture and exert a good influence. Psychological counseling might get at the heart of the problem and move the child away from the path leading to deviant behavior. An important aspect to note here, where there's some intervention at this stage, the child who has been rescued may go on to disappoint the family, be truant, not respond overtly to the better environment, but as an adult, he might never offend, at least not to the extent of committing abductions, rapes, and murders. Someone on the track toward antisocial behavior can be retracked only so far. The chances are that he will become a largely dysfunctional adult. For him to be reshaped and return completely to normal behavior is unlikely. That means that when these murderers are caught and incarcerated, the prognosis for their rehabilitation is extremely poor, because, after all, their problems have been developing since their childhoods. These are men who have never known how to relate properly to other human beings. It is not likely that such a fundamental interpersonal skill can be taught in prison. They have to be re-educated in how to be human beings who care for other human beings as individuals. To turn angry, resentful, aggressive men into sensitive people who can fit well into society is almost an impossible task. Recently, one man who was in prison for repeated child molestation described quite graphically just this inability to change his behavior. In his fantasies for years, he had had sex with underage boys, he said. In prison, despite attempts by the authorities to turn his mental affections toward adults, even toward male homosexual adults, his daydreams and autoerotic play always centered on boys, and he knew it would stay centered on them forever, whether in prison or out. Most previous researchers into the mind of the murderer thought that the roots of violent behavior were in childhood trauma. A boy who had been assaulted at age 6 would grow up to rape women. But not all of the rapists or murderers we interviewed had been assaulted during their childhoods. My research convinced me that the key was not the early trauma, but the development of perverse thought patterns. These men were motivated to murder by their fantasies. I knew long before I started killing that I was going to be killing, that it was going to end up like that, one multiple murderer told us. The fantasies were too strong. They were going on for too long and were too elaborate. After the murders actually began, the fantasies continued. It is a development, the killer reported. Getting tired of a certain level of fantasy and then going even further and even more bizarre. It got off in such deep ends that I'm still not exposed to the worst of the fantasies that I have. All the murderers that we interviewed had compelling fantasies. They murdered to make happen in the real world what they had seen over and over again in their minds since childhood and adolescence. As adolescents, instead of developing normal peer-related interests and activities where they couldn't completely control what went on, the murderers retreated into sexually violent fantasies where they could, in effect, control their world. These adolescents overcompensated for the aggression in their early lives by repeating the abuse in fantasy, but this time with themselves as the aggressors. As one murderer told me, "Nobody bothered to find out what my problem was, and nobody knew about the fantasy world." It is because these murderers deal in fantasy that we characterize serial murders as sexual homicides, even when physical penetration or other sexual acts do not appear to have been perpetrated on the victim. Sexual maladjustment is at the heart of all the fantasies, and the fantasies emotionally drive the murders. Fantasy is defined as a happenstance unattainable in normal life. A normal male fantasy might be to have sex with a perfectly beautiful movie star. Carnally possessing a sex goddess is not a perverse thought, merely the mental expression of a wish that is, for most people, beyond what can be attained. An abnormal fantasy might be to immobilize and slash such a movie star during sex. The normal guy accepts the fact that he's never going to have access to Madonna or Cher or Jane Fonda or whoever he thinks is really cool or sexy. He finds a substitute. Normal people learn to accept social control and moderation as limits on their behavior. The deviant person, having had very few true restraints on his behavior since childhood, believes he can act out his fantasy and that nobody will be able to stop him. Many young men had a crush on Jodie Foster, but only John Hinckley felt he was entitled to stalk her in New Haven, send her notes, and tape record their conversations while planning to assassinate President Reagan. Similarly, we all know that many children play with pets and are fascinated by wild animals. They generally don't engage in deliberate torture, however. One deviant felt entitled to slit a dog's stomach to see how far it could run before falling into death spasms. Another attached cherry bombs to cats' legs and made many cats in his neighborhood three-legged. A third strangled a cat without compunction, but was outraged and deeply hurt when someone fed ground glass to his own dog. The offender's greater commitment to their fantasies deepens as they become loners in adolescence, subject to the onset of puberty and sexual arousal. Aggressive, and with a feeling of having been cheated by society, they channel their hostility into fantasy. Several murderers reported early attachments to high-heeled women's shoes, female underwear, rope for strangulation and asphyxiation, the last not only for others but for themselves, principally for sexual stimulation. 12-year-old Edmund Kemper played gas chamber with his sister, a game in which the sister was required to tie him in a chair and click an imaginary switch that released the gas, so he could keel over in the chair and die, a joyless, hostile, repetitive game that mingled sexual and death themes. A second adolescent male masturbated openly into his sister's undergarments, often in front of his sister's, and then wondered why the family was angry at him. A third, at age 15, dragged younger males into the bathroom of his treatment facility to force them to have anal and oral sex with him, recapitulating the way he had been victimized at age 10. A fourth boy had been discovered at age 3 with his penis tied to a bureau drawer, strangling and stimulating it. At age 13, he was found by his parents in the bathtub, trying to tie up his penis and his neck to a bar above the faucets. By age 17, the young man turned his aggressive instincts from himself to a young female, whom he abducted and kept all night at gunpoint. The fantasies are characterized by strong visual components and by themes of dominance, revenge, molestation, and control. Whereas the normal person fantasizes in terms of sexual adventures, the deviant links sexual and destructive acts. Normal fantasies of interpersonal adventure are fused with abnormal attempts to degrade, humiliate, and dominate others. Most normal fantasies have at their center the idea that the partner will have as much fun as the dream.